WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscoane. President Obama delivered his much-anticipated plan for getting Americans back to work to a joint session of Congress last night.
The purpose of the American Jobs Act is simple: to put more people back to work and more money in the pockets of those who are working. It will create more jobs for construction workers, more jobs for teachers, more jobs for veterans, and more jobs for long-term unemployed. It will provide a tax break for companies who hire new workers, and it will cut payroll taxes in half for every working American and every small business.
The speech was a critical one for the president, given persistently high unemployment and widespread fears about a double-dip recession. He repeatedly called on Congress to come together around the legislation.
There should be nothing controversial about this piece of legislation. Everything in here is the kind of proposal that's been supported by both Democrats and Republicans, including many who sit here tonight.
And joining us with more on the president's speech is Jim Tankersley, economics correspondent for the National Journal. Jim previously covered energy and the environment, as well as political and economic issues for the Chicago Tribune. Jim, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is David Marks, senior editor at Politico. David is the author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning, and was previously editor-in-chief of Campaigns and Elections magazine. Welcome, David, to Radio Times.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Well, so I'd like for both of you to give us your assessment of the president's speech last night. If there were any surprises, did he go far enough? Give him a report card, if you will. Jim, I'll start with you.
Well, I mean, from economic terms, I think the most important thing to know about the president's speech is he appears to have learned an important lesson from his first economic stimulus bill, the Recovery Act of 2009. This is a more, to quote an Obama land phrase, timely and targeted stimulus plan. It gets more money out faster to fewer special interest groups and more just to getting people back to work, getting more money into Americans' hands. Well, that aside, though, there are some big flaws here, and the biggest one, the most important one, is that it does almost nothing to help the housing market, which is the big drag on our economy still right now.
And I noticed, Jim, you mentioned stimulus. I noticed that he avoided the S word last night in his speech.
Right, but that's what this is. I mean, most of the proposal is classic Keynesian stimulus to revive the very much flagging consumer demand going, which is holding back the economy right now. And so this is spending money and cutting taxes in order to get more consumer spending, more people hired, more activity going in the economy again at a time when activity is really slowing down.
So not necessarily a surprise to you, the content of the speech.
I mean, I think the biggest surprise of the content was, A, how big it was, and, B, the areas that he left unaddressed. I mean, the $450 billion price tag is larger than most folks had expected, but if you really believe that we need another big Keynesian stimulus, it's probably not big enough to fill the full, what economists call, output gap between how well the economy is doing right now and how well it should be doing.
David, Mark, what do you say?
I agree with Jim about what some would call the tepid nature of this, depending on your ideological perspective. I thought it was striking how the president essentially spoke in plain English. He said, you should pass this bill. I don't believe he used the word infrastructure one time. He said jobs over and over again. So I think the president was really trying to kind of get past the Washington speak. It was almost as if he wasn't even speaking directly to members of Congress, even though they were his actual audience right in front of him, trying to go to those independents and moderates out there that, of course, will be crucial if he has any hope of winning re-election in 14 months.
Do you think it worked, David? Do you think that people, by and large, the folks particularly most affected by this, were swayed one way or the other?
Honestly, I think a lot of people are still skeptical of the whole notion of stimulus, even though he did not use that term. I think they look back to the 2009 episode and mention some of the shortcomings that Jim just discussed, and they say, why do we want the government spending more money? That may or may not be the correct attitude, but I'm not sure he's hit the mark there, and that he's really convinced the public that that's the way to go. And maybe he can. He's in Richmond, Virginia today. He's got some other stops in Ohio and elsewhere coming up, and maybe he can turn the tide. But at this point, I'm not sure people really believe it.
And David, would you say then, given the fact that he is headed to Virginia, which is Eric Cantor's territory, to Ohio, John Boehner's territory, that this was, to some degree at least, a campaign speech?
I think clearly the president is trying to show that he's being more aggressive versus the Republicans, and that goes back to the actual timing of the speech, when it was originally supposed to be a night before, of course, during the Republicans' debate. The president, the White House, sort of had to back down on that, but I think that's all part of a broader message that he's being more aggressive, that he's not going to be playing defense, and that he's really going to be setting the agenda in the next few months.
Jim Tankersley, let's break down a little bit what exactly the president is proposing here, because it was, as we've pointed out, a combination of some tax breaks, some spending. What are sort of the highlights of what the president's looking to do?
Well, it's a fascinating mix, and I think to David's point there, what we see here is the president is pushing forward a bunch of proposals that he can describe in terms of things that everybody likes, at least in some general sense. There's money in here. You could call it aid to states, but he's calling it money to keep teachers and police officers from being laid off. There's money in here for infrastructure, but he's calling it money to build things again, build roads. He actually mentioned a bridge between Kentucky and Ohio, which would be, of course, Mitch McConnell's state to John Boehner's state. Mm. He's very concrete things that they put in. Now, the centerpiece, the most important part of the plan and the most expensive part is a several layered payroll tax cut. He wants to continue the payroll tax cut for workers that's currently in place as part of the tax deal that passed last December. He wants to have payroll taxes for the first $5 million of payroll for firms, and then he wants to get rid of payroll taxes entirely for firms on any worker that's added to the payroll or on any increased wages that are given to a worker. So basically what he's trying to do here is use the payroll tax, which nominally funds Social Security. He wants to use a temporary break in that to stimulate a lot more money in the hands of employers who will hire more and employees who will then spend it more, theoretically creating jobs.
And Jim, does that go far enough? I do remember hearing, you know, some entrepreneurs who were interviewed saying, listen, what we really need beyond a tax cut is people to buy our services. There was one, you know, florist who said, hey, the biggest thing the president could do for me is come in here and buy some of my flowers. I need business if I'm going to hire additional people.
Right. And so he's got a mix of that. I mean, he's not going to go buy a bunch of flowers, although, you know, Washington could use some flowers right now. It's quite rainy and gray. We could use some color. But he is going out and spending, you know, some direct government spending on things like, for example, schools. He wants to spend $30 billion on upgrading school facilities. Maybe that's buying something. That's buying construction equipment. That's buying people to install new air conditioners or new computers or whatever. He wants to do a wireless initiative. He wants to do the rehabilitation of vacant property, which means, again, hiring people with backhoes and trucks and home decor to come in and rehab foreclosed upon houses. So there is some of that, but that is a smaller price tag than the putting more money back in the hands of employers and employees part of the payroll tax cut.
David Mark, when we talk about infrastructure, and I know that the president didn't directly use that word, but he certainly did talk, as Jim pointed out, about, you know, bridges and that sort of thing. Are there concerns that those types of jobs, yes, they are jobs, but they're not permanent jobs necessarily?
Absolutely. That is a growing concern, that those jobs would be temporary, they would be over within a few months, and then you would have those workers right back in the same position that they are right now. There's a kind of an undercurrent, unstated, not said, to that whole infrastructure roads bridges argument. It's that you need roads and bridges in Republican districts as much as Democratic districts. And as Jim just noted, there's that bridge that he's visiting that links Kentucky and Ohio, the homes of the Republican leaders. And it's essentially saying to Republicans in Congress, I dare you to oppose projects in your own district. And he was not quite coming out and saying it that way, but it's an old political trick by presidents, but I think this time President Obama may have the upper hand on it.
And David, we talked a little bit about how this will fly on Main Street. Are people swayed one way or the other? What about Wall Street? What do you think Wall Street's take on the speech will be?
I think they want to continue to want to see the deficit cut. If it looks like it's going to mean more spending, a growing deficit, that, of course, we saw what the ramifications were with the debt ceiling fight not long ago, that would have very negative ramifications on Wall Street. But so far, I think the main intended audience are Main Street people. And as Jim just noted, that payroll tax issue, I think, is actually key. If that expires, people are going to see less money in their paychecks. And if members of Congress and the president think people are upset now, that's really going to get them mad.
Jim,
Tracy, can I jump in really fast on that?
I
think that's a really good point. But on the point of Wall Street, I would also like to point out that, you know, the market volatility we saw in August was a reaction to a couple things. As David very correctly noted, it was a reaction to the debt ceiling deal and this growing sense that Washington has sort of lost any ability to solve problems. But there was also a real reaction to the dramatic fall off in economic indicators we saw. The first quarter, second quarter growth just looked anemic in the revisions, and it really appeared like the U.S. and the global economy were stalling. And I think that is what Wall Street is really worried about also. So Wall Street wants a plan that's going to get the growth rate back up, because they are worried about corporate profits, which have been very strong thus far, falling off if growth really does just really stall out or head back into recession territory.
And Jim, you wrote in an earlier piece that it was important for the president, in your view, to give an explanation of how we got here, how we got into this mess, and sort of what his prescription would be. Did he do that to your satisfaction? Did he explain well enough how we got into this mess to begin with?
No, I think it's one of the big disappointments from the speech. I think the president still has not articulated his vision of why it is that this recovery has slowed and is maybe on the brink here of a double-dip recession, and what it will take to get us out of it. You know, the Republicans have a simple message on that, which is government has hindered the recovery, whether it's too much spending or too much regulation. The president's team for months and months and months this year was insisting that the temporary factors were slowing down the recovery, but that things were going to get better. It was just a matter of time. The president seemed last night to have abandoned that position. He said recovery has stalled. But he didn't tell us why, and he didn't tell us exactly why his plans would fix it. And I think that's really important. If I'm on Main Street America, I want to know why the president thinks things aren't getting any better for me, and I want to know, because I'm not sure I can judge his proposals for fixing things if I don't know what his diagnosis is.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. Does it matter to the person who's been laid off, who just wants to get a job yesterday, you know, how we got here as opposed to when can I get back to work?
I think it matters in the context of we've seen a lot of things tried over the last couple of years to revive the economy. They haven't worked as well as people on Main Street would like. I mean, the president has this counterfactual. There is a lot of evidence suggesting that the first stimulus did preserve a lot of jobs. But the unemployment rate's still over 9%. Mm. If you're on Main Street and don't have a job, if you're one of the 14 million unemployed Americans, you're not interested in sort of the academic argument of how many jobs it preserved. You want to know what's a plan that's going to get things started now. And if you're going to get if you need to judge the president's plan, it must be on the basis of what's different this time, what's going wrong.
I'm going to stop right there, Jim, because we have to take a break. But we're talking about President Obama's highly anticipated speech on getting Americans back to work. What did you think of the speech? We'd love to hear from you when Radio Times comes right back.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents its new fall program lineup. Featured speakers include Richard Clark on the 9/11 decade, Pulitzer Prize winner Dana Priest on espionage, Richard Brookhiser on James Madison, Tony Horowitz on John Brown, Chris Matthews on John Kennedy, Joseph J. Ellis on John and Abigail Adams, and more. For tickets and more information, 215-409-6700 or online at constitutioncenter.org.
Right after 9/11, Americans united in righteous anger and resolve. As we returned to daily life, our world was transformed.
There was a younger generation whose first sense of their civic identity was formed around the crisis of 9/11.
For more stories and an invitation to share your experiences, go to whyy.org/after9/11.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And Newsworks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at whyy.org and newsworks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow Newsworks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about President Obama's speech last night. It certainly was highly anticipated because he was planning to talk about jobs and how to get Americans back to work again, and that has been a huge subject, with unemployment remaining very high and people very skittish about whether the economy really is in recovery or whether we're looking at a double-dip recession, perhaps. We have been talking with a couple of political experts who know their way around politics. We're talking with Jim Tankersley. He's economics correspondent for the National Journal, and we also have David Mark with us, who is senior editor at Politico. And gentlemen, we left off talking about some of the specifics about what the president had to say and how effective they were or were not, depending on your point of view. But want to talk about some other things, and first want to invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. We would love to hear what you think about what the president said. Did you feel better about the prospect of Americans getting back to work? Do you think that this is the beginning of a new day? Do you think it was more of the same? Where do you fall into that mix? The number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 888-477-9499. So we left off. We want to talk a little bit more about some of the specifics. Jim, you mentioned earlier in our conversation about the housing market and how critical that is to really getting the rest of the economy back on track. And I think we need to spend a little bit more time talking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's the problem with the housing market. As long as it continues to slide, which still appears to be the case, and particularly home values to continue to slide, so many Americans are going to feel as if their own personal wealth is declining. I mean, so many of us have money wrapped up in our houses, whether it's that's our retirement nest egg or it's just we had counted on it to appreciate. I mean, a lot of small business owners or prospective small business owners borrow against their homes in order to start businesses. So the house value is a really important thing in the American economy. And so long as it continues to go down, that's going to keep people sitting on other parts of their money. They're going to save more and spend less because they just don't see that security in an appreciating home value. Yeah. And that's the case right now. We've got a foreclosure glut. We have, 3 million homes still in foreclosure. We have housing prices continuing to slide in almost every metro area. And until that slide stops and until we work through this foreclosure crisis, we are not going to see the sort of level of consumer spending we probably need to really both rescue the housing market and get houses being built again and get construction workers back to work, but also to rescue other parts of the economy that are missing that consumer spending power.
Yeah, especially since everything is linked. David, do you feel that the president went far enough in addressing housing in his speech last night?
I think he just kind of touched on it tangentially, although, as Jim says, it is a key part potentially of this recovery. The problem is, among the problems is, even if people get a good job, say, in another city, they actually find a decent paying job, if they can't sell their house, they can't necessarily move. And so there are all kinds of ways that people are just kind of paralyzed in the housing market. And until the prices at least stabilize, there's big trouble. I actually think the administration might have some success pushing what might be called a bailout for homeowners. In some form. I know they've talked about reducing interest rates, that sort of thing. Even though the term bailout has a bad term, that's the kind of issue that affect people across the political spectrum, I think actually would get a fair amount of support.
Well, there certainly have been cries for bailouts for Main Street, ever since the bailout took place for Wall Street quite some time ago. What about, David, trade agreements was another thing that, came up in the speech last night. How well do you think the president covered that?
He touched on it. These are always a tough sell in tough economic times. They're the kind of things that tend to do much better when the economy is flourishing. Trade deals are kind of funny because they're less partisan than other issues. You can have some Republicans who normally would favor free market economics opposing them for various reasons. Democrats from liberal Democrats who usually would favor a higher governmental role in favor of them under some circumstances. So this is becoming somewhat more of a Republican push, but it is going to be a tough sell. Particularly, you have the with South Korea, Colombia, elsewhere, you have particularly some places arguments over human rights, labor rights, Democrats are not going to be real enthusiastic about them. So I think it's more of a talking point than an actual agenda item.
Jim, what do you say?
Well, I think that the big thing that Republicans want to see from the president is actually to submit the trade agreements to Congress. He can stand up there and call upon them and call upon them to pass them, but he hasn't submitted them to Congress yet. And that's because he's trying to work out a deal that will get some trade adjustment assistance for the displaced factory workers in the U.S. who are the ones who drive the opposition to trade deals. He wants to get that coupled with with ratification of the trade agreements. But I mean, I totally agree with David. The politics are difficult, especially, you know, in a state like Ohio, which the president absolutely wants to win. Trade is not popular. If you'll recall, when he was trying to win the Ohio primary in 2008 against Hillary Clinton, he started talking about renegotiating NAFTA, which, of course, he hasn't done. But this is the sort of thing that again, plays well to a Republican crowd and with the business community in particular in a speech, but is harder for him to move because of his own constituencies.
Jim, in the president's defense, as we look at the items that he talked about last night, and anytime we're talking about, you know, the economy, the recession, the unemployment, we're talking about problems that have been a very long time in the making. Is it fair to expect that an individual or even a group of individuals, in the case of Congress, can make real progress real fast with a problem that has taken a long time to get to this point?
That's a great question, and I think there is reason to believe that this problem in particular is harder to solve more quickly. There's the best research on this is by a pair of economists, Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart, who talk about how financial crises are different and that it just takes a lot longer to recover from them for a lot of reasons. And we're in the middle of that right now. Now, good policy choices can help with that recovery. And in particular, what we're seeing is the rest of the world is going through a similar kind of slump right now as we are, but we have some advantages that they don't. I mean, the biggest one, liberal economists would say, is that we can borrow at really cheap rates right now, the government can, with treasuries at an all-time low, in order to spend some money to help sort of accelerate that process of returning consumer spending to the economy. Now, the downside, I mean, the other side of that is conservative economists would say there's a lot of inefficiency in our tax code that we could get rid of, and there is a lot of regulation in the economy that they say if you strip away, you could create business confidence to help accelerate, again, that recovery. So I think Congress has tools it could use, whether you believe the conservative argument or the liberal argument. The problem has been that this Congress and this president are so divided on which tools to use that they haven't been employing anything.
And we certainly want to talk about Congress and how likely this is to get through Congress, because that really is one of the big questions following the speech. But I do want to get to the phones for a moment. We want to start off in Raleigh, North Carolina, and welcome Bill to our conversation. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. I wanted to basically comment on one of the comments y'all made about the first two stimuli, not just one stimuli, but the two stimuli by Bush and by Obama, that it had an effect, but nobody wanted to hear about that. And those who don't want to hear about it ignore history. It did keep us from those two stimuli plans, keep us from a greater recession or depression. And the farther we fell at that point, the farther we'd have had to dig out a hole now. And so people keep saying, well, it didn't save all our jobs, we're not back to 5% unemployment, ignore what happened in history. And in history of the Great Depression, we went to such great levels, lower levels of unemployment and despair. And part of the reason was we did not do anything at that point when it first happened, or in the first few years after that, to try and stimulate the economy in the United States. So we had some stimulus. It kept it from going down so far, but now we want to return to the problem.
Well, Bill, let me have our guests respond to your point. And Jim, you're our economics guy. So what do you think about Bill's concern?
I think that the independent research, and I really do trust the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, has shown that the stimulus, that both those stimuli, as he points out, first under President Bush and then under President Obama, did save several million jobs, kept us from being in a deeper hole, absolutely. But I would also point out that the economies right now that aren't really trying to use fiscal stimulus, that are in fact doing the opposite, austerity, cutting budgets, raising taxes, trying to bring down their budget deficits in hopes of spurring growth, aren't having a lot of success with that. So we don't have a great example right now of anyone who is cutting to grow. We also don't have the big empirical evidence that says, yeah, we've boomed our way out of this recession by spending a lot of money that we borrowed. So that leaves us in this murky middle. I mean, I think that the counterfactuals are hard to prove, but the best economic research does say that the stimuli did preserve a lot of jobs.
Well, we'll go next to Pittsburgh, and we'll welcome Elaine to Radio Times. Hi, Elaine.
Yeah, hi, good morning. My question has to do with corporations' responsibility in this whole conversation. I noticed that Obama's speech last night was a little bit more geared to maybe what he could do for small businesses and encourage them to hire more, but I don't see corporations pulling their share, Apple sitting on $76 billion in cash. Why aren't they putting that into the job market? Why aren't they investing in research and development more? It seems when they do hire these large corporations, they hire overseas. We need these big corporations, all of them, sitting on these piles of cash to put it into the job market and get this thing going.
Well, Elaine, thank you for your call. I'd like both our guests, David, I'll start with you, to respond to that.
The answer from any corporate executive would be they'll start spending more when there's demand again for those products. And until that happens, they would say they have no choice but to sit on that cash. I think the caller does make a good point about R&Ds, maybe some other research, development, infrastructure-type projects that they might be undergoing. But it's real simple. Corporations will start hiring those people when people start buying their products. Until then, they're not going to risk their capital for what could be another economic downturn.
Jim, what do you say?
I totally agree. And just to add to that point, I mean, and to the caller's point about creating jobs overseas, the growth right now in the world is coming in developing nations, in Brazil, in India, in Russia, in China. So if you're a multinational corporation and you want to spend money at a place where there's growth that can help you make money, it's a pretty easy calculation. But I think that the question that every U.S. policymaker should be asking themselves right now, given the growth situation and the changing international competitiveness landscape, is why, if you're a multinational corporation, would you create a job in the United States today?
I want to ask you, since you mentioned China and India and some of these emerging economies, just about the tone of the president's speech. And David, I'll start with you on this one. It sounded like he was a coach almost, motivating his team. At least that was my sense. You know, are you really going to sit by and allow China, you know, to bypass us at our own game? What did you think about that sort of challenge, that tone that he used, using China as an example?
It was an interesting approach, with the president almost lecturing the opposition party on what they should be doing. As I mentioned earlier, I don't think Republicans sitting in Congress were really his audience here, so he could sort of get away with it rhetorically. He may very well be right on the merits. I'm just not sure that's going to go over real well with the folks who have the power in their hands to pass or not pass that sort of legislation.
Let's go to Kutztown next and bring Fred into our conversation. Hi, Fred.
Yes, hello. My thoughts on this are, I'm a baby boomer, 55. I'm going to be downsizing for my next move. I'm not going to be spending more money. The kids that my son's living with us at home, he's okay financially, but a lot of his friends, they're all maxed out on their college loans. So they're living at home. I don't see them jumping out and buying a house anytime soon. So if construction for new homes is the key to the economy a little bit here, from what I heard, I don't see that happening. And I think the baby boomers are bunkering down, and I think it's going to be a long, slow climb out of this thing. That's my, no matter who's in office. That's my thoughts on it.
All right, Fred, thanks for your call. Jim, what do you say?
Well, I think, you know, there's an interesting variable left out of that. I mean, I totally agree with the caller that is, in fact, exactly the situation we find ourselves in right now. In the Republican debate this week, an interesting idea was floated, which has been floated a few other places, but by John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah, who made the point that one of the best ways, as some economists have noted, to increase demand for housing would be to increase legal immigration to this country. If you let more people come to the United States, especially if you there's some really off the wall ideas like auctioning off visas or other things, but if you bring people who have the money to buy a home to the United States, they're going to need to live somewhere. And you could absolutely speed up the demand for new houses by bringing in people who would, in fact, want to buy them.
And that opens up a whole other can of worms, David, doesn't it?
Well, certainly immigration is always a fraught subject, but there may be a way to, as Jim says, to actually get something through there, or at least get, make it seem like something can get through if there's an economic incentive. And that's always been one of the arguments of the pro-immigration forces, that it's not just about being humane, it's about creating business opportunities. And perhaps that will break through. I don't know that John Huntsman is likely to be the Republican nominee, but maybe that idea will carry through to whoever gets the nomination.
Yeah. In our last few minutes before we take another break, I want to talk about Medicare and Medicaid, because the president did address that to some degree last night, saying that we've got to fix it in order to save it. Jim?
Yeah, and that's going to be a really, really interesting – that's the punch unthrown in this speech and the really big question. What will the president propose in terms of how to pay for all of his ideas here? It's going to be part of this bigger deficit speech he's going to give, which the White House says will include, what, like $2 trillion in budget cuts over 10 years. And that's going to have to include some sort of mechanical changes to Medicare, because exploding medical costs are absolutely the big drivers of America's future projected budget deficits. So the president has to address Medicare somehow. He's signaled he's going to. I mean, that is, I mean, the hottest of hot buttons right now. But he's going to have to go there, and it will be fascinating to see what he chooses to do in terms of do you raise the retirement age? Do you start limiting care in some certain instances? What can you do to rein in Medicare costs?
And David, I would think that would be a tough sell with the president's own party to some degree, right?
Absolutely. We're already seeing severe pushback. Just on Politico.com this morning, we had Senator Bernie Sanders writing, independent of Vermont, not technically the president's own party, but still from the left end of the spectrum, saying he doesn't want to see anything that would reduce benefits to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid in any way. And the Democratic House members who are on this super committee that are supposed to negotiate some deficit debt reduction measures are all stalwarts against those kind of cuts. At least they say they are. Going in, it seems like they're going to stick to their word. So I think the president would have great problems with his own political base. That might help him in the long run if he can prove to moderates and independents that he's serious about all sides making tough compromises, but boy, he would be risking the wrath of his own party under those circumstances.
And yet, David, those moderates and independents are critical at this point for him, aren't they?
That's right, and that's really who the president and his reelection team care about a lot more than liberal Democrats. They can essentially take the left for granted. They wouldn't say it that way, and they've tried to make some overtures to the left, Democrats generally, but it's really those moderates, independents, unaffiliated folks who are going to be crucial in the traditional battleground states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, now Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, etc. And the president and all the Republican candidates know that as well.
We are talking about President Obama's speech last night on getting Americans back to work. We would love to hear your thoughts about how effective the speech was. Did you feel better or not so much better after you heard what the president had to say and where we go from here? We also want to talk about Congress, their response, and how likely the president is to be able to get this legislation through, which is a critical question. We'll talk about that and more when Radio Times comes back. If you'd like to join us, it's 888-477-9499. And we're back in a moment.
Medford Lees proudly supports WHYY, a Quaker-related, not-for-profit community celebrating 40 years of service. Medford Lees offers two campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, featuring arboretum settings, residential home designs ranging from townhouses to garden-style apartments, varied contract options, a self-governing residence association, and comprehensive on-site wellness and health services. Further details at 800-331-4302 or medfordlees.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the Air Force's Bay State Winds Clarinet Quartet performs a couple of songs in tribute to the men and women who have served since 9/11. And NBC News chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel tells behind-the-scenes stories about his recent reporting from Libya, Egypt, and Afghanistan. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What do progressive Democrats think of President Obama's blueprint to get people back to work? We'll hear from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Also, a 9/11 diary from Rhett Miller of the old 97s. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowane, and we are talking, as are most people this morning, about President Obama's address to a joint session of Congress last night. He was talking about getting Americans back to work, about how to create more jobs all across the country, given the high rate of unemployment, given fears about a double-dip recession. We've been talking with Jim Tankersley, who is economics correspondent for the National Journal, and David Mark is senior editor at Politico, and we are also talking with you. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this. Specifically, how would you like your legislators to respond to what President Obama said? Certainly, the President and Congress have locked horns over these kinds of issues many times in the past. We want to talk about that next. If you'd like to join us, it's 888-477-9499. And gentlemen, I would like to talk about Congress and their response. Love to hear your thoughts on the body language and on how likely the president is to be able to get this legislation through Congress. He's had lots and lots of roadblocks in the past. I'm wondering if this time will be any different. David Mark, I'll start with you.
Actually, the Republican response has been rather muted compared to what one might expect. It seems like House Republicans have actually gone on a bit of a charm offensive, or at least seem to have softened up a little bit, trying to raise their own approval ratings. They did not have an official retort to the president's speech last night. That may have been because that would have gone on during the opening of football season, and the ratings would have been even lower than normal under those circumstances. But for the most part, they were respectful. We didn't hear any catcalls, for the most part, in the way we maybe have in some previous speeches. So I think they've actually tried to dial it down a bit. And Majority Leader Eric Cantor actually came out and said that he could support some portions of the package that the president proposed, and that he's going to push for votes on them in the not-too-distant future. Now, that may just be a fraction of what the president wants, but at least it's not total gridlock going into this thing.
Yeah. He also, Eric Cantor, talked about the all-or-nothing tone. He said, you know, I don't know that I like that all-or-nothing tone, but certainly do see lots of common ground, which I think people found maybe surprising and encouraging at the same time. Jim, what do you think?
I think that there's a better chance of something from this passing than any of the proposals the president has just sort of tossed out there piece by piece in the last few months. And I totally agree that what we've seen from the Republicans has been this sort of, well, olive branch, okay, we can work with some of this stuff. But they're going to want the president to work with them on some of their economic priorities too. Right now, their biggest economic priority is to try to roll back some of the regulations either proposed or enacted that are out there that they say are harming hiring. It'll be interesting to see whether the president is willing to compromise on that. He drew some lines in the sand rhetorically in the speech about we're not going to just dismantle government and all of its health and safety protections and give everybody their money back. On the other hand, just last week, he basically tabled an ozone rule that would have set new standards for ozone regulation that business community and Republicans hated. And so maybe he is open to compromising on some more regulations down the line.
Hmm. And Jim, what about, I'm thinking about, you know, Boehner and some others in particular, and how the president kept saying, you know, this is something that you need to pass. These are all ideas that have been supported before, which leads me to ask this question. Can Republicans vehemently oppose anything that the president put out without looking like, hey, they're the ones who are holding up the progress here?
I mean, I think it depends entirely on the framing, and David's going to have a better sense of this than I do. But absolutely, it's easier for them to oppose something that they can just label, this is more spending. We oppose more spending. We were elected here to oppose spending. We're not going to do spending. It's harder for them to oppose things like tax cuts, which, again, is, as the president called out, you've all taken this vow, this pledge not to raise taxes, and don't make an exception now.
Yeah.
I think that's more likely to be an area where he finds some common ground with them, because it's much more in the Republican philosophy wheelhouse.
Hmm. David, what do you say?
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think this is one area where the president has kind of the political upper hand. As I mentioned earlier, if that payroll tax were about to expire, whatever the merits of the long-term economic merits of it, that would mean paychecks for most people increase by $40, $50, perhaps more, depending on one's salary, and that's tangible. In this kind of economic climate, I don't think lawmakers really want to have that happen on their watch. Maybe it's a good stimuli, maybe it's not, but I suspect there will be some kind of deal on that before too long.
We'll go back to the phones now to Bluebell, and we'll welcome Norma to Radio Times. Hi, Norma.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment is, number one, President Obama is a smart man. I think we all can agree on that. All I want to hear out of Washington from all sides, all the parties, is positive talk, and I would like to see them lockstep behind him. I don't know about you guys, but the people in Washington are not living in the real world. We can't put food on the table. We're working double time at our jobs. We can't fill our cars up with gas. We have to take care of our elderly parents because we can't afford a nursing home. Whether they agree with it or not, he's the president of the United States, and these are unprecedented times. We need to get behind him so that we have some hope that we can dig ourselves out of this mess. That's my comment. And Mitch McConnell should be embarrassed at his comment last night, saying that the president's speech was just a stump speech, a political speech.
Well, Norma, thank you so much for your comments. David, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond.
I appreciate the sentiment behind the caller's views, but I don't see a lot of the both sides really coming together. They'll do so only if they deem it in their own political interest. And they may very well overlap at this point where both sides actually have reasons to work together. The retort that Republicans would make is that the president was given a shot. He had large Democratic majorities in Congress when he took over, and the economy really has not improved for 2.5 years. That's a powerful argument for a lot of people. So that's one that the Obama reelection team is going to have to overcome in the next 13, 14 months.
And David, that also leads me to ask about approval ratings, because there's been some talk about that of late, about the president's approval ratings being quite low, but Congress is being lower still. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Right. Depending on the poll, approval ratings for Congress go down to all of 13%. Now, that could be a little bit misleading, because in that classic line, people disapprove of they dislike Congress, but they like their own member of Congress, although polls show even that is dropping. So it's got to be a concern on the Hill. Another concern for Republicans, both presidential candidates and those in Congress, is that the president's personal approval ratings are still reasonably high. They're still above 60%, depending on the poll you look at. And in American politics, perception counts for a lot. People vote, oftentimes do not follow politics intricately for years on end. They make up their mind in the closing weeks of an election. And if they just seem to like a candidate, that can go a long way.
We'll go back to the phones to Westchester, and we'll bring Drew in on our conversation. Hi, Drew.
I had the impression, listening to the speech, that the president was almost like a guy standing on the edge of a cliff who grabs the guy next to him, wraps his arm around him, says, look, I know if you want me to go down, you're coming with me. And it's very much in tune with one of the polls I saw last week that way over 70% of people wanted a complete turnover in Congress. And he has kind of latched them in and brought them, made them part of the game. And if they don't play along with him, not only will he go down, but they're coming with him.
Well, thanks, Drew, for your call. Jim, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think the president, you know, to the extent that he can make that kind of threat, which I think was, remember, he's making a political threat to Republicans, just like the caller just said right now. But I think he also, the line that got seemed to get the most bipartisan cheer in the entire speech was when he did appeal to everyone's sort of deeper sense of common good. You know, we have 14 months until the next election, but that's 14 months longer than the people who sent us here expect from us to act. Now,
again, the problem is that in Washington, I mean, I think that the thing that is most disconnected from the real world about Washington is that everyone here is obsessed with winning, including the president and including the Congress, and to the perhaps the detriment, I mean, definitely the detriment of the 14 million unemployed Americans out there who don't care really who wins. They just want a job. And I think that's, you know, the frustration from the callers here and the frustration that you hear when you're out around the country is, geez, why can't these guys just sit down and really figure out something that would actually put people to work that they could all agree on? Now, there's deep ideological differences, but that doesn't matter to voters. They just want to see some action.
Speaking of ideological differences, David, the Republicans, a number of them, came out with plans of their own over the last several days. Let's talk about that a little bit. Did you hear anything that was radically different from what the president is proposing, anything that is likely to gain any traction?
Depends who you talk to among Republicans, which plans you're looking at. Generally, they call for lowering taxes and less federal spending, which is precisely what President Obama warned against last night. There was one member in the audience, I believe a Republican member from Louisiana, Jeff Landry, who held up a sign saying, drilling equals jobs. So he had his own parochial interest. And I think that kind of represents how a lot of these members view it. They have certain industries that they'd like to see given favorable treatment back in their own districts or states, and that's what drives a lot of them. So bluntly put, Republicans want less spending, lower taxes, and Democrats want something else. And as we've been discussing, maybe, just maybe, they can find some room for compromise.
Jim, what are your thoughts about some of the Republican plans that have been put forth this week?
Well, I think the most impressive and interesting plan put forth this week was Mitt Romney's like 94-page jobs plan, which is fascinating for a lot of reasons. First, because it really is a studious plan, although it very much differs ideologically from the president's. I mean, Mitt Romney wants to do some really big corporate tax cuts that he thinks would spur growth. But secondly, the most interesting part to that, going back to one of the topics we were talking about earlier, is Mitt Romney got to the president's left on China. He talks in his plan about cracking down on Chinese currency manipulation, which is basically code for let's risk starting a trade war with China in order to make it so that they have to buy more of our products and we're not just buying a bunch of cheap Chinese products with no reciprocation. That is a very populist program. I mean, it's a very popular one, by the way. Also, Congress has passed similar bills that have not been signed into law that have gotten wide majorities. But it's where you would expect a Democratic president to be at this point, and not a conservative Republican presidential challenger.
We'll go back to the phones to Hopewell and bring Chuck into our conversation. Welcome, Chuck, to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My comment, basically, I am somewhat of a news junkie, and I did like his speech last night. One of the things I do wish that President Obama would do would be to basically be a little more plain in speech about, for instance, he could have said something along the lines of, I am aware that this will be a help for my campaign next year, but we can't wait. He did say something about not waiting 14 months, but I think he needs to be even more plain in speech. Most politicians on the Hill are aware of what's behind the curtain. They know the wizard's back there. They even know most of the levers. Your average American is not aware of all the machinations behind the curtain.
Well, Chuck,
I think that I would really like it if he would be even more plain and basically pull the curtain back a little bit in speech and state it so that your average American doesn't need to make the behind-the-scenes connections.
Chuck, thank you for your call. And Chuck brings up an interesting point, David, because certainly one of the comments that I have heard and read since last night is that the president, a lot of people thought, was fairly plain-spoken.
Yeah, I think the president got about as close to touching on politics as you can get. I think it's pretty obvious that he's running for re-election, that this is part of his campaign agenda. It would be an interesting reaction if he were just to come out and admit that. But the president, politicians generally don't like to come out and say, especially in official settings. It's one thing when they're on the campaign trail, but when you're actually on government property, such as the House chamber, it gets a little dicey. There's nothing illegal about it, it would seem, but I think he might get criticized for impropriety under those circumstances. Mm.
Jim, in our last couple of minutes here, what should we be watching for next? We've heard the speech. We know the president is hitting the road as early as today. What do we look for to happen after this?
I'd watch two really important things. The first is, how sustained will the president's effort to sell this be? Will he, not just today and next week, campaign for this plan around the country, but will he keep doing it again and again and again and again? Will he keep the pressure up? Or will he just sort of let this go if a month from now there's nothing has happened? I mean, I think that's a big test for him. The test for Republicans will be, how quickly do they coalesce around their own sort of counter proposal, particularly in the House? Where, at what point do they take the things they like from the president's plan, package it with the things that they want done also, and sort of shoot it back and put the ball in the president's court to say, hey, this is what we're willing to do. Now you meet us halfway or whatever. I think that will tell us how serious the debate will actually be on getting something done.
And David Mark, in our last 60 seconds, what do you say? What are you going to be watching for, and what should we be watching for in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I agree that it's important to see how sustained the president pushes. I'm also going to be watching for those trade agreements that we just were looking out for, because that's an area in which both sides have some skin in the game. Both sides are going to have to rally their own bases, convince recalcitrant members to come along. So I think that will be a good test for how bipartisan really both sides want to be, or whether that's just rhetoric that we hear on television.
So it's going to be a big test for sure for both sides. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for taking time to help us understand a little bit better some of the nuances of the speech, to really just glean some more understanding of what this is all about and where it is likely to be headed. Our guests have been Jim Tankersley, economics correspondent for National Journal, and David Mark, senior editor at Politico. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
And
I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain, and you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.